not two, but three of the four couples were planning on getting married and then immediately spending like 1 to 2 years, thousands of miles apart. You know, because one of them was going to, gotten to a great grad school, and the other had a really good job in the city that they didn't want to leave. You know, and one person was finishing up med school in one place, and one person was starting med school in another place. And you kind of just want to shake them and say, what are you thinking? And, you know, you try to have those conversations, you try not to be judgmental, because at the end of the day, you know, what I found is even when you find people walking into just disastrous situations, my wife and my theory has been, we want to be there when the, you know, shit hits the fan. Basically, we want to be friends with them still. We want to have built that trust that we can speak grace into their lives, because chances are you tell someone, don't do it, and they're going to not do it anyway. They'll either not do it and resent you, or they'll do it and never talk to you. You know, people are strange. People are crazy. And I think Ira captures that really well. Now, all that being said, we continue to hold on to this illusion that we're free. You know, like, yes, okay, maybe I look at some things on my computer that I ought not to, or I eat a little more than I should, or I, you know, don't really, you know, if you're really Christian, you know, I don't have quiet time as regularly as I should, but if I really buckled down, if I really made a choice to do the right thing, I could do it. I could get it done. We harbor that, that denial, like Aaron talked about yesterday. We lie to ourselves. And so I remember, about 10 years ago, you know, my wife and I went through sort of a second conversion in the way that a lot of you have here. You know, we become Christians. I had definitely gone through a time in my life where I had become super controlled because I had, you know, when we were dating, I had a little indiscretion with another lady, which I think was good in a way. It really brought home to me the reality of my own sin. But then also in reaction to that, I started trying really hard to control my thought life. You know, I recognized the connection between my thoughts and my actions, and I was like, okay, I just need to get my thoughts under control. You know, Jesus says that lust and adultery are the same thing, therefore I shall stop lusting. I'll just stop it. I'll just cut it out. And actually, there's an amazing This American Life episode called The Ten Commandments, where this young Christian talks about doing the exact same thing. He talks about adultery. And so I was mildly successful with that for a little while, but I finally reached a point where I realized that I resented and hated God because he was demanding of me things that I could not do. He was telling me to be perfect as my Heavenly Father is perfect, and I just couldn't do it. And so I took this week-long, I was working for this youth ministry and did this ongoing education to go week-long class with Paul Zoll called Law and Gospel, you know, and heard, again, this biblical New Testament message, which I'd probably heard in the past but forgotten. But all the way I was feeling the judgment, the self-condemnation, the despair, the hatred for God, the rebellion, the peculiar mixture of self-righteousness and self-loathing that Aaron talked about, these were all products of the law. You know, this word from God that said, be perfect as I am perfect. You know, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. And Paul talks about this, how the law inflames the sinful nature. And about how the purpose of the law, the commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, is not to make us better, but to show us that we're bad. And I had come to terms with the fact that I was bad, but I had no theological framework for understanding that. So I heard Paul talk about the law and the gospel and the book of Galatians and 2 Corinthians and Romans, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is actually in the Bible, I can't believe it. Why have I heard this before, at least not, you know, for a while? And it was, you know, Luther says that when he discovered that the righteousness that Paul talks about is not our righteousness, but it's the righteousness that God gives to us as a gift. He says, I call you righteous, even though you are not. Luther says it was as if the doors of paradise were open. And I felt the same way. And a lot of the people who are here, who worked for Focus, were in that class and had our lives totally turned upside down. And that means that half the people hated it and wanted to have nothing to do with it. But interestingly, all the people in that class who hated the message, none of them are in ministry anymore. You know, most of them are actually now lawyers, and there's nothing wrong with being a lawyer. I'm serious. I'm dead serious. There's nothing wrong with being a lawyer. But for those of us who heard this radical grace message and the ineffectuality of the law, you know, we sort of all sold out. You know, like, nothing mattered anymore except living this message, proclaiming this message, getting this message out there, because it's just, it's not being told anymore. So, in the context of my, you know, aftermath of that class, I was reading everything that I could get my hands on, specifically by Paul, and he had just come out with a book called The First Christian about Jesus, which is kind of a, it's a reaction to the trend in 20th century scholarship to want to see Jesus as a Jew, and honestly, Jesus was a Jew, but sometimes Jesus becomes so Jewish that he ceases to be Christian. He ceases to have anything new to say. That, you know, N.T. Wright, I'm not a big fan of N.T. Wright, but one thing which I do like, which he says, is you need to have a Jesus that's both intelligible in his context and also crucifiable. Intelligible and crucifiable. And a lot of 20th century Christian scholarship has so deeply contextualized Jesus in his Jewish context that he no longer he sort of no longer becomes crucifiable, except maybe to kind of the Roman government as a political revolutionary. You know, so Paul's trying to recapture Jesus's, that he was the first Christian. He wasn't just Jewish, that there's a break between Judaism and Christianity, between Old Covenant and New Covenant, Old Testament and New Testament. Anyway, right towards the end of this book, I read this passage and it sort of drops like a bomb in my life. And Paul's talking about original sin, which he says that original sin is the one empirically verifiable Christian idea, which I think Reinhold Niebuhr said. Is that what he said? Chesterton, sorry. Next slide. So here's what he goes on to say about original sin. Understand, too, that this teaching, going directly back to the historical Jesus, refutes a characteristic American idea, the idea of free will. Or, and there can be some theological terms in here, just forget it, it doesn't matter. Just hear the words that you understand, that's all that matters. The idea of free will, or Arminianism, as it is termed in historical theology. So often, sincere Christians, Catholic and Protestant, refer to something they call the, quote, doctrine of free will. They have not been taught that, in italics, there is no such doctrine. It is true that after 1711, the year when the Church of Rome officially rejected Augustinianism, you know, the St. Augustine, Catholic teaching began to sound as if the Church taught free will. But in fact, the idea that a person has free will to choose the good over the bad was almost everywhere in Christianity understood to be a heresy until 1711. Christians, like everybody else, enjoy believing that they possess free will, that they can do what they want, but experience, and certainly the words of Christ in his antitheses, contest this idea down the line. All you need to do is consider the addicted, the touchy, the alcoholic, the angry, the angry, the rebellious, the conforming. Did I catch anyone in those? Did anyone untouched? Okay, good. And you will see that the freedom people want to have is much more limited than they think. Empirical observation contradicts the conviction that people wish to convey to themselves that they are free. The American film masterpiece Magnolia is an assault on the idea that people possess free will. So I wish he could have been more clear in that particular passage about what he was trying to say. But I remember reading that and turning to my wife and being like, I don't think Paul's Hall believes in free will. Like, what's going on here? And so he was doing a little book signing party up at some club, and we went there, and you know, we had a little chance to talk, and I said to Paul, I said, Paul, I just finished your book, The First Christian, and I really liked it, but it sounds like you don't believe in free will, and it is very characteristic Paul's all the way. He's like, of course not. You know, free will was refuted by the 6th century, Council of Orange, and he walks away. and no one's believed in free will since the 6th century. Of course not. And I was like, oh, okay, thanks for that. So as I said upstairs, my wife and I went home, and we sort of said to ourselves, well, what might it look like to decide to stop believing in free will? You know, I recognize the ridiculousness of that statement. But what might it look like if we decided to believe in bound will, as Martin Luther calls it? And as I said, what we found, and we are not by nature compassionate people, what we found is that we started to have a little more mercy for people. You know, for like the crazy mom in the shopping aisle screaming at a kid. You know? And this was sort of when our kids were sort of still too little to be screamed at. And what you generally find is that the moment you say, I will never do X, you are guaranteed to do it someday. You know, all those things that your parents said to you that you swore you would never say, you will say them all. and all those ways that you promised yourself you would never be like your mother or father, you are your mother and father. And there's sort of nothing you can do about it. And that's what I found. The older you get, the more that is the case. So we found ourselves, when we could look at people and see the awful things that they were doing, including ourselves, including each other, and say, you know what, maybe they can't help it, and they're doing the best that they can, and they're under, who knows what kind of pressure they're under, who knows what's going on in their life, who knows what kind of internal chemical issues they're dealing with, or external, you know, relationship issues they're dealing with, you know, and recognizing that's what we want. We want people to look at us mercifully, you know, because, you know, people know when they're screwing up by and large. You know, they know it. But the last thing they need is to someone to stand over them with the voice of condemnation. Say, you know, they're condemned enough. You know, what they need is a word of mercy and love and grace and acceptance in the midst of their out of control sin. And of course, that's the Christian message. And just to back up this whole idea of free will, you know, I don't know how many of you come from sort of confessional backgrounds, you know, Presbyterians or Anglicans or whatever, but in the 39 Articles of Religion of the Anglican Church, Article number 10, which I love the 39 Articles, they're succinct, they're to the point, they're deeply reformational, they're wonderful. So here's what Article 10 says, and it's called Of Free Will. Imagine that. The condition of man after the fall of Adam is such that he cannot turn and prepare himself by his own natural strength and good works to faith and calling upon God. In other words, we cannot in and of ourselves prepare ourselves for faith. We can't, in and of ourselves, we can't believe. And our good works don't do anything to help us in that effort. As a result of this, we have no power to do good works pleasant and acceptable to God without the grace of God by Christ preventing us. And they say preventing, it's like, if you took French, you know, like a veneer, sort of to come before, preventing. So without the grace of God by Christ coming before us, that we may have a good will and working with us when we have that good will. So in other words, God works in us faith. God calls us to himself. God is the one who plants any kind of desire to do anything good in us at all. And then when we have that desire, he's the one who makes the good work happen. You know, as Paul says in Ephesians, they say, we are God's creation, created in Christ Jesus to do good works which he prepared in advance for us to do. That anything that we do is all from God. So, no free will. And for those of you who are wondering, you know, biblically, how do we justify this? You know, there's no place really in the Bible where it says free will does not exist. But I would point you to, you know, for example, Romans 7, you know, which is maybe our, I don't know, our patron chapter from Mockingbird. You know, where Paul says, I know what I'm supposed to do, I know what I ought not to do, and I find myself not doing the stuff that I should, and doing the stuff that I shouldn't, and I can't stop. I can't stop. Who will save me from this body of death? Thanks be to God in Jesus Christ. And then later on in Romans 8, and I'll talk about this at the end, he also talks about the bondage to decay. What does he say? He says that the entire creation has been subjected to futility. Not of its own will, but by the will of the one who created it, in the hopes that we would be liberated from our bondage to decay and would enter into the glorious freedom of the sons of light. That we would let go of our desire to be stronger and more in control and more powerful than we are, and give in to the fact that we are creatures. We're not the creator, we're not in control, we are creatures, and that we would receive God's mercy and grace for us as we are, and find freedom in that. Find freedom admitting the truth about ourselves. You can also look to the history of Israel. You know, it's just, I mean, the whole Bible is a comedy of errors. You know, here's a group of people who for thousands of years have known exactly what they needed to do to get God on their side, and they never do it. And they're sent into exile, and they're brought back, and they're sent into exile, and they're brought back, and they're sent into exile, and they're brought back. It's like, you'd think that they would get it at some point, and they never, ever, ever do. Or we think about Peter. You know, the apostle Peter. I honestly think that when Jesus says, you know, you are Peter, on this rock I shall build my church. I think he's joking. I honestly think it might be a joke. Because Peter is like the farthest thing from a rock. He's so inconstant. You know, he's the one who confesses, you know, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. And then Jesus starts talking about his crucifixion. And what does Peter do? Pulls him aside and begins to rebuke the Son of God. And Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." And then Peter says, "You know, I will stick with you to the end. I will never deny you." And Jesus says, "I tell you, before the cock crows, you'll deny me 3 times. And then, you know, and then of course Peter does that, and then Jesus seeks him out on the beach. You know, after he's died and resurrected. So what does Peter do? He goes back to fishing. You know, goes back. He's like, "Well, what do we do now? I don't know. Let's go fish. Let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to, you know, just sort of forget it all happened and go back and fish." And Jesus finds him on the beach and reinstates him. And then we have this other apocryphal story, but it has the weight of truth. You know, that Peter's in Rome and massive persecution breaks out and he flees the city. And the risen Jesus appears to him on the, I don't know if it's the Appian Way, I'm just going to say that because it sounds poetic. appears to him on the Appian Way and says, "What are you doing?" And Peter says, "You're right, I'm sorry." And he turns around and goes back and he is crucified. He requests to be crucified upside down, not feeling worthy to be crucified in the same manner as before. So it sort of works out in the end. You know, not really then. But we see this idea of the bondage of the will and human recidivism, you know, that we always sort of go, you know, we always go back. We see it born testimony to in the Bible. Okay. You still may not buy that. So what I want to do is I want to show you a few different clips, a few different examples of the bondage of the will, about how we are less in control of ourselves than we wish we were. And I'm really bummed out. I'm glad you're all here. I downloaded it from the Apple Store, but Apple is telling me that this projector is not licensed to project the clips. So I can do it on my computer. So if you want to gather around, you know, we can watch it on the small screen, as it were, and hopefully if the audio is enough. The first clip is from this show called Community. It's called Leap Day, and it takes place on February 29th, you know, the leap day of the leap year. And here we go. And this is the very beginning, so you're not...
I'm the one who's behind me.
Oh, wait. No.
Unable to do his
Uh-oh.
Job.
So I got... Hold on. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So here's... what's Dunphy's first name? Phil Dunphy. Here's Phil Dunphy being very excited about leap day and coming in and waking up his kids. And I want to say... I want to apologize in advance if any... women are offended by this clip. I hope you won't be, and it'll quickly become clear why you might be, but I'm hoping that you won't be. Okay, here we go. I ran by my wife, and she thought I was okay. And she's a feminist, so.
Come on, boys, it's leap day, not sweet day. Woo!
I love leap day!
It's kind of a big deal in the Dungeon House. This year, we even got many involved.
You're given this gift of 24 extra hours. You can't waste it at work or school. You have to do something extraordinary, something shocking.
This year, the entire family is taking a trapeze class.
How extraordinary is that?
It was my idea.
How shocking is that?
I can be spontaneous every 4 years.
I can't wait.
Dave?
Okay, let me fast forward, because we don't need to see all of it. And I've got more. Okay, so here they are back in the house.
Axe. More people are killed by knife-wielding strangers than from trapezing.
I'm thinking about going home now.
Honey, are you okay?
I look so sad.
Oh, no, not so good.
What's wrong?
Nothing. No emotions, just feeling emotions.
She was like this last month. The month before. What? I could kill someone! No, I can't hear you! This stupid phone, there's no reception in this stupid house! Ah!
You got no. Yeah, we all had. But females living or working in close quarters could eventually get on the same cycle, but I always assumed that was a story designed to keep women out of the submarine core.
This isn't milk. What's wrong with me today? My brain's not working right.
No.
Everything.
No, we just need to be extra sensitive.
Phil, honey, when do we need to leave?
Whatever's good for you, sweetie. Maybe 20 minutes? Whenever you're ready. It happened. Satan's trifecta. The day I most dreaded had fallen on the day I most loved.
Okay, we'll stop there. It goes, all right, so. I hope Satan's trifecta. And then he goes on. Well, here, I'll just show a little one because it's kind of funny. Can I?
You're going to ruin trapezing. They don't even catch me. Why are you so afraid of them? They're reasonable. Why don't we just suggest
they're reasonable.
They stay home considering they're all in the mission?
First rule of dealing with the cycle. You never mention the cycle. You tiptoe around it. The woman's actually taking great pains to hide the monster she's become. But if you acknowledge it, it brings the monster forth.
My God. There's three of them.
It's okay. I have a plan.
Okay. So, I hope that's okay. I hope no one's terribly offended, but I want to say that this bears witness to the reality that there are forces going on inside of us, and that's true whether you are, you know, a teenage boy or my 7-year-old boy who's, you know, almost a teenager, Mr. Touchy Feely. You know, or it doesn't matter how old you are. You know, there are things going on inside of you over which you have no control, and you find buttons getting pushed, and you find yourself reacting to pieces of food, and, I mean, who knows what it is, but I'm sure you've all had the experience where you see yourself becoming that you wish something you wish you weren't, and even if you're trying to repress it, you know, even if you're trying to keep it down, I mean, coffee does it to me sometimes. Not all the times, but there have been times when I've had a cup of coffee, and I just turn into a raving psychotic lunatic, you know, and I'm just angry at everyone in my world. And then usually what happens is my wife is incredibly gracious and she sees it and she's very patient and she sort of takes it. And then about an hour later, I'm like, oh my gosh, I am so sorry. I am so, so sorry. And yet, you know, if she was to react against me, it would just get escalated. You know what I mean? So, and honestly, I love his, He's merciful. He's compassionate. He it's his favorite day. He can see it's about to get ruined, but he's looking at his wife and his daughters whom he loves and says, you know what, they're a little bit out of control. We'll manage this somehow. Okay, so that's sort of internal forces. And like I said, I mean, there's no, as Aaron said yesterday, there's no point in telling an anxious person to chill out, to relax. You know, the last thing you need to hear when you're anxious is relax. The last thing you need to hear when you're being angry or unreasonable is that to stop being so angry or unreasonable. That there's this Christian idea, this New Testament Reformation idea that the law cannot create what it demands. You know, that when people get out of control, they know they're out of control, usually. They know they shouldn't be. They know they shouldn't be angry. They know they shouldn't be emotional. That they shouldn't be anxious. But someone being told to stop being those things is of no help whatsoever. The law, even though it is good and right, of course, it's good that you should be mellow and happy. But the law cannot create what it demands. Only grace and love and mercy can. Okay, next clip. And this one I think I actually can put up on the big screen, if it'll let me. Is this working? Okay, here we go. This is from The Wonder Years. And season 1, episode 3, is called My Dad's Office. And it's really about Kevin Arnold coming to terms with his father, who his father is. So, that's really dark. Come up. We'll see.
While the female remains with the young, the male ventures forth into a hostile environment to find sustenance. He returns after an unsuccessful foray, aggressive and unpredictable. Notice the reaction of the startled mother and her offspring as they begin to sense the presence of the male.
Your father's had a bad day at work, so no noise. does work.
Works work. The irritable male gives out unmistakable signals that tell the young to keep their business.
Well, let's go play fetch.
Good idea.
When my father had a bad day at work, he'd just sit in the dark by himself and watch TV. We learned early on that this was a danger signal, and we adapted our behavior accordingly. And when he had a really bad day, I'm talking about a very not good day, he had this telescope, and he'd go out in the backyard and just look through it for hours.
sure that's what you want?
Yes. Sure.
I learn something new every day.
Yeah?
Hmm?
When did you decide you wanted to become a manager of distribution and product support services?
Sorry, just a funny sort of a thought. Really wanting to be the manager of distribution and product support services. I mean, it's a good job, but it's not what I thought I'd be doing with my life.
What did you want to do?
What, are you kidding? Professional baseball player.
Not really.
Really? Well, I did have a fallback position.
This job?
Ship.
Captain of a ship?
Yeah. You know, one of those big ocean liners or a freighter or an oil tanker. Be out there in the ocean in the middle of the night, navigating by the stars. Of course, I use instruments for all that now, but I didn't know that. Yeah, I thought that'd be the greatest thing in the world.
How come we didn't do it?
How come? Well, you know, one thing leads to another. Went off to college, met your mom. Next summer, I got a job on a loading dock here at Norcom. The rest is history.
You gonna make a great ship's captain, Dad?
Eh, probably not. Probably get seasick. You know, Kevin, you can't do every silly thing you want to in life. You have to make your choices. Try and be happy with it. I think we've done pretty well. Have you?
Yeah. I think we've done great.
But as we walked back to my father's office, I suddenly realized something that made a lot of things make sense. My dad was too good for this place. Sure, it was a good job, and we were all lucky he had it and all that. But my dad had something finer in him than S-14s and distribution reports. I'll never forget how I felt at that moment. I felt that my father was a great man.
What the hell is this, Arnold? This is incompetence, just plain incompetence.
Look out, Wysanski's a little...
No, never mind Wysanski. He works for you. Now, this is the third major screw-up in your department in the last 2 months. Now, if you can't hire competent people and supervise them, we can find somebody that can.
It's being taken care of.
Well, it sure better be. Oh, and one more thing. The next time that I try to get you on the phone, you better be there to take the call. Now, do you read me, Arnold? Do you read me?
Yeah, I read you.
Good.
Thank you.
amazing times that he had with his father. And I think there are two things that happen in this clip. One is, obviously, Kevin sees why his dad comes home angry so much of the time. He experiences firsthand the judgment and the condemnation and the pressure and the yelling and the belittling and all the sort of stuff that his dad has to deal with at work, and then has some compassion on his father. And so, like you said, that this was never scared of him quite the same way. But I think the other thing that happens, and I think all of us have experienced this in our lives, he comes to see his father as a human being. His father goes from being kind of this idealized figure, both for good and ill. You know, all he can see is his father's anger, or remember the times when his father was so great. And he goes to seeing how his father is just a person. And that's kind of iron going through. And it happened a lot later for me. You know, it probably happened after college. And I think I grew up deeply disappointed in my father in a lot of ways. And there was, he did some things of which he wasn't proud and I wasn't proud. And there was a time in my life when I thought that if I just came down on him hard enough, that I could change him, that I could control him, that I could sort of make him do right. And then at some point, I came to this realization that he was never going to be the father that I wanted him to be. But maybe I could accept him as he was. Maybe I could love him for who he was, both good and ill, and have a little bit of mercy and compassion on him. And then, ironically, what happened was, as I came to terms with my frustrated desires, as I lost something, Kevin says I lost something that day, I found that he actually started to become the father that I always wanted to. But I guess, for our purposes and the bondage of the will, we idealize all sorts of people, most especially our parents. But when you come to see what they're a product of and where they came from and how they grew up and their ambition and all the sorts of things that drove them to be who they were, and their woundedness. I think of my, my parents are divorced now, and I think about my mother and who she is, and the fact that she was sort of abandoned by her father and ended up kind of taking care of her alcoholic mother when she was in middle school. And you start to see your parents clearly for how they are. You can have a little bit more mercy and compassion on them, and then also on yourself as well. And you can look to your own past and start to understand who you are. Okay, that brings us to our last video clip from United States of Tara, which, as I said, apparently, has anyone up here ever seen that show? A few people? Okay. I'm going to give you a little warning here in full disclosure. There's going to be R-rated language in this clip. Okay? There will be a few F-bombs dropped and stuff like that, but I think it's worth it. I think it's good enough to show. And I hope you won't be too scandalized. If you need to, I'll sit down there with my back turned. If you need to excuse yourself, that's totally fine. Again, we can't watch it up here. We have to watch it down here. This is the very beginning of the first season of the pilot episode. And not to give anything away, but just so you know what's going on, United States of Tara is about a woman, a wife, a mother, who has multiple personality disorder as a result of a deep and profound stress that's been happening previously in our life. So this is from the first episode, United States of Tara. Come around, and we'll watch this.
This is Tara, obviously. It's Thursday the 12th. Looks like I've got about 4 minutes or so. So I just want to explain where I'm at right now while I'm still lucid. See, I'm under a lot of pressure lately. I've been hired by the mayor's wife to do this 17th century Rococo nursery for her unborn son. She wants a gold diaper genie and a giant wall fresco depicting herself as a pregnant saint. This is what I do. I create opulent environments for women who hemorrhage money. And I'm good at it, too. I rule. I have no problem keeping track of a million things for my clients, but I'm Unfortunately, I can't seem to micromanage my daughter's vagina. See this? It's a prescription for morning after pills. As in, the morning after skanky, sweaty, teen sex. I found this in Kay's backpack last night. Part of me wants to play hit mom and just applaud my daughter for being responsible, and the other part of me just wants to sew her up. I mean, Kate's always been a very affectionate kid, very huggy, got a lot of Valentines in grade school. Maybe I should have seen this coming. I just...
That's my 7-year-old.
Just deal with it. It's fine.
Why are you here instead of mom?
Oh, your mom's in a bad place mentally.
Yeah.
Is it my fault?
Kinda. Remember those kill pills I helped you get at the free clinic? Your mom found the evidence and she is tweaking.
Hey, well, how'd she find out?
She went on CSI and that pubic batch fell in the backpack.
Mom violated monkey.
That bitch.
Total bitch. Are those my new skinny jeans?
Don't they make my ass look fine?
Sure, fine for 40.
You know how much it blows being 15 and stuck in this ancient body?
Look, I have a muffin time. Must suck.
You suck.
Clothes suck.
Let's get out of town. Buy a bunch of new stuff.
I don't have any money.
Oh, I read a Tara's wallet. We're fully laminated, baby.
Tea! Is this why I love you the best out of all the elders?
Drugs, not hugs.
Oh.
I love that gloss on you. Makes you look porno.
Really?
Bring this.
Well, you're gonna hang up to dry because I smoked it badly.
Hey, Marshall.
What's up, Rocker?
Mom.
No. Mom keeps her ass crack in check. It's tea.
I can see that now.
Jello pudding is up for the children.
Bitch, the vanilla ones are mine.
Hey, Marshall, you want to go downtown? We're going to buy cheap hot clothes that make us look insecure.
I have to write a paper on George Cukor for Intro to Film.
Pudding is good. Day.
T, can we please go before Dad gets home and ruins our lives?
Too late, girls.
Hey, here comes the maxi pad now. Yo, I'm fucking afraid, Dad.
T? You're back.
Fucking A.
That's more respect than I've gotten all day. The subcontractor's a real shit.
Oops, I'm a vegetarian now, Max. I don't eat. Besides, the hormones in that clunk can make you get a third nipple.
Really?
It's for you guys. I got a MySpace bulletin about it.
Or you can have my cool slut here.
Don't coddle her. When she's going to eat with us, you got to cooperate. Remember, we talked about this.
Pussy.
Shocking.
So, Dad, I got the lead in the recital tomorrow.
What happened to Darcy?
Asha ate with bananas and gum for like 2 months. So, send her to St. Mark's to put a tube in her stomach.
That's hilarious.
Very sad, actually.
Cougar crossing.
And Charmaine.
Thanks.
Charmaine, what would we forget?
That's her, that's her,
don't worry about it.
That's her sister who came by to take her to a Pampered Chef party. And her sister is obviously distressed by her, you know, multiple personality disorder, so she wants to talk to her husband out in the garage about it.
I'll get Marshall to go with you. I think he needs a new deviled egg carrier.
It's not about that, it's about her. I mean, it is really hard for me to see my sister like that. I mean, I never thought she'd still be this way.
She's really not doing that bad.
I mean, why can't she just stop? I mean, it's not even a real disease, Max.
It's real, Charlie. You grew up with her, you know better than anybody. Look, nobody's trying to imply that you don't have a right to be angry. You do. We're all angry at the crazy. But I've been living with this for 17 years. Married to it. You just take it to Pampered Chef party.
I don't know. You're right. Oh, sorry to have to live this way, honey. We really deserve so much better.
No, I don't. Really.
Let's see. Fast forward a little bit more. I can find my... There it is. So she finally gets a little bit too out of control, and her punishment is to be, well, not punishment, but she gets sent to this shed to sort of work out her issues as part of her therapy, because she's in massive therapy. So she's been sent out to the, T has been sent out to the shed to kind of hopefully be transformed back into Tara.
And Charmaine is a hose beast. I just saw T going out to the shed. Is she going to have a shit fit?
I don't know.
Well, I don't want the neighbors to know either, so brace yourself for Thelonious Monk.
Why do you do that?
So they can't hear orange. Big whoop. How is she? She wasn't that bad. I mean, she was only here for a couple hours. Do you know she's a vegetarian then? Am I high? Maybe a little, yeah. Listen, I want to thank you for being such a strong, supportive kid. Mom, I mean, because of you, we get to be interesting. You like being interesting?
What? I think I have munchies. You want anything from the kitchen?
No thanks, I have checks. So.
Okay. We can turn the lights back on. That's our last video. Okay. Hopefully that wasn't too extreme. So just I hope you got the narrative. She was in the midst of a stressful moment. She sort of transitioned to one of her alters, who's this 15-year-old girl named T, and evidently T had a joint. And so that's why at the end she's like, am I high? And she goes to the shed. She sort of comes back. She apologizes to her husband and her son, but sort of has no recollection of what's going on. When we get to season two, we see first sit down with the family, and they try to reconstruct, because when she has these episodes, she doesn't really remember what's going on. And I guess, you know, in one sense, we watch this, and we say, that's insane. Like, is that even real? Like, I don't know how we feel about that. It's kind of, you know, it works maybe more better as a metaphor than anything else, but it's a little crazy. But then I think,
you know, I showed this to my wife a couple nights ago for the first time, and all we could sit there and think was, you know, that's us. Like, that's, you know, we see this crazy person with multiple personalities, but you know what? We have multiple personalities, too. And my wife even said something interesting. She said, you know, honestly, RJ, sometimes I wish I could just be kind of a crazy 15-year-old girl. That I could sort of stop for a little while being a pastor's wife, definitely, because that's no fun at all. You know, that I could forget to sort of stop being a mom. That I could stop being a wife. That I could just go off into some la land and do what I want to do. And we see that a little bit, actually, with not really multiple personality. But when her mom comes to visit, when my mother-in-law, Kathy, comes to New York City to visit, it's like she's transformed. My mother-in-law got married really young. She had a wife really young. She's been through a lot, a few different divorces. And she basically never had childhood. Also, my aunt had a very traumatic experience where she was, well, basically some guy came to the house and picked her up and has her with a doctor in the field. And that sort of dominated a lot of the family stuff going on when she was little. But my mother-in-law never had a childhood. And so when she comes to New York City by herself to come hang with us, she comes to party. We play cards, we drink a lot of cognac, she takes long walks. Like, she comes to party and to, like, recapture that part of her youth, which she never had because she got married at 16 before her boyfriend went off to Vietnam, you know? And you probably see that in your own life. And do you remember what it was like to go away to college and then to come back and then to feel like you changed to a whole different person and you had a whole new, you know, you sort of discovered yourself and all these people you met saw you for who you really were. And then you came home and all you were was, like, you know, the little brother, or the big brother, or the middle sister, or the, you know, you just reverted back into, you found yourself reverting back in patterns of behavior that you thought you'd left behind, you know, by going to college. But to some degree, we all have multiple personalities. We have different personalities at work than we do at home, than we do at church a lot of the time. So that's us. Another thing that I find to be so refreshing about this show, and also, has anyone seen Lars and the Real Girl with Ryan Gosling? That's an amazing movie about a guy who falls in love with a blow-up doll that he's convinced is real. And the amazing thing is he lives in this little Midwestern town where no one treats him like he's crazy. They treat him like he's rational, and they treat this girl, whose name I can't remember, as if she's real. They love him enough to sort of go along with the fantasy. It's very bizarre, but deeply touching, and he finally comes out of it. But the love, the acceptance, grace, the mercy that her husband and her kids have on her, you know, thanks to you, we get to be interesting. You know, it's not always like that. You know, they have their freak-out moments, and they wonder why they're saddled with this, but I love that scene in the garage where Tara's sister says, "You deserve better than this," and he goes, "No, I don't." You know, not really. Like, where does it say that I deserve to have a completely sane spouse? Where's that written? You know? And so, she is in therapy, and she's working towards healing. And the reason this is happening is because she decided to go off her meds because she wants to sort of become a whole human being. But that can only happen in the context of a family that accepts her as she is and loves her through it, and even sort of loves the alters. You know, they kind of like tea. They kind of like this, you know, crazy and profane and sort of disgusting 15-year-old. And I got to say, you know, when I watch this, all I can think is I want to be that husband. You know, I wish that I was as merciful and loving and easygoing. And it doesn't just extend to his wife. It actually extends to his children, who clearly have some serious issues going on. You know, the daughter's having... you know, unprotected female sex, and the boy is sort of having this, you know, sort of sexual identity issues, and I don't know, season one is good, season two is not that good, it's not that great of a show. But, as a model for mercy and grace and acceptance being transformative powers in the lives of broken people, it works really well. I think it helps me get in touch with something. Okay, last thing.
You guys mind? Well, I sort of have to tie it together. Oh, we've got 10 minutes, so we're good.
I want to play a clip from Radiolab, which I think ties it all together. And specifically, it It's a tangible example of how God treats us in the midst of our recidivistic bound will. And it comes from an episode called Escape. Radiolab is another kind of This American Life type podcast show. It's really incredible. This particular story is about a man named Christopher Gay, who's also, he's become known as Little Houdini, because he has broken out of jail 13 times. And he sort of, he steals things, always modes of transportation, like buses. He became very well known, I guess, in 2006 when he faked his own death, broke out of jail, stole a Walmart tractor trailer to drive home to see his mom because she was on her deathbed before she died. The cops were on his tail, so he crashed the tractor trailer into a field. He escaped into the woods. This was in Tennessee. He managed somehow to steal Crystal Gayle's tour bus, like the country music star, and drove it down to like Daytona Beach, Florida, where he was reapprehended, put back in jail, and then escaped again. So the guy who wrote the original story that kind of went viral, who I think worked for the St. Petersburg Times, wanted to do a more in-depth story on the history of this guy, Christopher Gay, because clearly he's got some issues. And what he found was that Christopher and his two brothers and his sister had grown up in really, really, really rural Tennessee without electricity, without running water, without enough food to eat. His parents had gotten divorced. He'd ended up with his father, who abandoned him. So he had to sort of scrounge and steal food. He would go over to his grandfather's house, who made him and his brother, made them have fist fights, and whoever won, he'd give food to. So that was that's his past. And this explains why he sort of got in this pattern of behavior. So we're going to pick it up there, where he's just said, you know, how much his grandfather hated him and used to stick his dogs on him. And here's the solution he and his brother came up with to try to escape their situation. And then we'll go past that, because that's deeply depressing, but then it gets better. I think this is queued up, I hope. It's queued up.
How was their life? Beating each other up for food.
He had dogs. He'd stick his dogs on us.
So one night, one of them went and found their dad's rifle, an old .22, and a tube sock full of rusty bullets, and went out behind the barn, lit a tire fire, and made a suicide pact. Cotton was going to shoot Chris in the forehead, and then shoot himself. And Chris closed his eyes and put the gun to Chris's forehead. Chris heard him whimper, and he opened his eyes, and Cotton said, "I can't do it." And Chris said, "Well, let me do it." He took the gun, he put the barrel to his brother's head, and he couldn't pull the trigger either.
And they were 10 and 11 at this point?
10 and 11, man.
But Ben says, if you take a step back, you can see that it's right about here, at this point, that Chris and his brother started to steal. Like, really steal.
They started out, like, on bicycles, and then they went to, I guess, four-wheelers and motorcycles. It was all stuff with wheels.
Yeah. Chris remembers going with Cotton to sit on a bluff.
That was on Interstate 40. We would go wash trucks for that.
And they would dream about getting in a semi and driving far away.
And they went to, I guess, four-wheelers and motorcycles and cars, and gradually got bigger and bigger and bigger.
So one day when Chris was 17,
he stole a semi. Didn't even really know how to drive it.
But I found up inside the keys was in. So I started it up.
And from there, there's really no looking back.
Can I pause you right there before you continue? Let me just name some modes of transportation, and you tell me yes or no what you've stolen. A semi. Bulldozer.
Yes.
Skid steer.
Skid steer.
Tractor.
Backhoe.
Anything that flies?
I actually got in a helicopter once, and we got in there and started flipping switches, and we finally got it. We got the blades where it rotate, but it was at a low, low thing. We got scared and got out of it.
Boy, this is his life for more than two decades.
Stealing things that move, getting caught, and escaping. Stealing things that move, getting caught, and escaping. So eventually, he became that guy on TV.
A Little Houdini who had police on the run in 6 states.
But then one night, something happened that seemed like it might break this loop forever.
He met a girl.
Yes.
Yes. Her name was Missy.
She was waiting tables at a little campsite diner. He thought she was cute.
And Missy?
He's a smooth talker, I'll give him that.
Yeah. She liked the way he talked.
Yeah, I was taken right off the bat. And
a few months later,
I got pregnant with my daughter, and me and him
lived in together for a while. Life was really good.
We still had a little money in the bank, and I was working good for Gregory Construction. Had a good paying job, ran a bulldozer, and I was actually going to school in Lebanon to get my CDL license.
We had a nice trailer, and it had a refrigerator.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I really, really liked it.
As a matter of fact, I was talking to my daughter last night.
I came real close with my daughter.
She remembers it like it was yesterday. He got her a dog. She named him Blackjack, first puppy she ever got.
That right there was the...
It was the best moments and days of...
The happiest days in, I think,
in my life.
I ever.
But then, things got complicated. So one day, when Chris and Missy were driving the car together...
We were going right through the middle of Nashville, and...
Chris says, look, I gotta tell you something. I stole something.
I stole a bobcat tractor.
From a construction job.
I sold it to make ends meet.
As soon as she heard that, Missy whipped her head around.
And I like hitting with a Big Mac right in the middle of Nashville on I-24.
A Big Mac.
Yes, I did.
But it was only funny for a little while. A couple days later,
somebody told on me. I
got arrested.
And he stayed in jail for about 2 years.
And then escaped. I don't know how exactly.
But before long, he stole again.
And ended up back in jail. Again.
And Missy?
I stayed by his side.
Again.
She was determined to come home from these escapes saying,
I just hate being locked up.
He didn't need away from you guys.
I didn't want to be away from my kids, and I didn't want to be away from Missy.
Each time he got locked up, Missy would write him letters.
I would send him money because I worked the whole time I was pregnant with my 13-year-old.
What kind of work did you do?
Worked on a sanding line. Sanded rocking chairs.
Chris, meanwhile, was thinking about his next escape.
And when he came charging through the front door,
thinking of roadkill,
telling Missy that again he had escaped,
I stayed with him.
Again. But this time,
I started asking for checks that was on a weekly basis and adding hours up that he'd been gone from time he left the house, which I would knock down riding time there and from.
You were keeping tabs on him?
Yes, I was.
She went so far as to take $5,000 out of the bank account that they shared and buy a trailer for them to live in, one that wouldn't move.
You know, I was trying more or less to make him do right.
And it seemed like it was working.
But then one night,
Chris came in after work and sat down in the living room with Missy and their daughter to watch some TV.
Next thing we know, we heard a loud beating at the door. Well, you know, I jump up and he jumps up. And next thing I know, he was, you know, moving that kitchen table and sliding it out. Next thing I know, he raises the rug up off the floor and he jumps down there and he says, cover it back up. So I cover it back up, put the table back and answer the door. And they came in and they walked all around the house. And they left.
He bought this house to keep him still and he cut a trap door.
Yep. He would stay up under his trailer the whole time. They were walking over top of him.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess it was more or less I was young. I knowed, but I was also in denial.
But eventually something happened that kind of forced her to admit just how bad things had gotten with Chris.
Day before Halloween, Danielle and her daddy went down to Walmart and she picked out a little witch outfit. But she was old enough then, you know, she's four. You know, trick-or-treating for a four-year-old, that was a big thing.
The next morning, it's Halloween.
Her daddy looked at her and said, well, baby, I'm going to work. I'll see you this afternoon. You know, I get home, well, get your outfit on you and we'll go trick-or-treating up in Nashville. And that afternoon, Danielle was sitting on the back step and she was just sitting there in a white t-shirt. And I asked her, I said, Danielle, what are you doing? I'm waiting on my daddy to get home, Mama. He said, we're going to go to Nashville and we're going to go trick-or-treating. I said, okay, he'll be back in a little bit. And she sat there and she sat there. And he never came home that night.
I don't really hear, like, I don't hear a lot of bitterness from you.
No.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
Why?
Well, as far as me being upset with Chris or hating Chris?
Yes, sir.
Is that what you're asking me?
Yes, sir.
How could you not forgive Chris? 18 years. That's how long I've known your boy. And I have seen firsthand where he lived. How he lived. I'm a fighter. I go to church. My kids go to church. I learned to forgive people. And Chris has had a hard life. He needs help. Help that I can't give him.
You thought for a while that you could give him that help.
Yes, I did.
I should have been up on the kids.
Yeah.
It'd take a lifetime of making this up.
Yeah.
You know, making up what I've done.
So what do you make of this story, Pat?
Well, somewhere along the way, for Ben and I, this story really became about the simple question, can a person like Chris, you know, grew up the way he did, can a person like that change? Or do you just never escape a childhood like that?
People live with how they grow up.
Yes, Missy, she says,
if two kids and a wife that he loves, if we can't stop him, I don't know what can.
But when we asked Chris, he said,
it's in my mind I'm going to change, and I'm not only going to change, I'm working to change.
Really?
Of course, he has said that before.
Truthfully?
What's different this time?
Okay. I know we're over time, so I'm sorry about that. So let me just sum it up, hopefully in like a minute. We are Chris, Jesus is Missy. We are Chris, Jesus is Missy. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to have moments of victory in our lives where we break free of our sinful, recidivistic cycles. Remember, he has a couple good years. But in the end, you sort of end up, most of the time, not really being able to run away from yourself. I remember one guy in a premarital course saying, you know, there's about one or two, maybe three issues that you and your spouse have, which will be the issues you are struggling with until you die. And that's true for married couples, it's true for people. You know, that sometimes we have this fantasy that the older we get, that the more the better we'll get, the more free we'll become, the more wise we'll become. When the truth is, you know, what do they say? You can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I think oftentimes, the older you get, the more bound you discover you are, the harder it is to change. Now, at the same time, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Gerhard Forde, who's a huge Mockingbird theological hero who's now dead. He was a seminary professor up in Minnesota, Luther Seminary, and towards the end of his life, some of his students said to him, Dr. Forde, now that you're getting to the end of your life, do you feel sanctified? Do you feel holier than you were when you were a kid? And he said, well, I maybe sin a little bit less, but it's basically because I'm old and tired. And I'm not sure that, you know, senility and sanctification are the same thing. But he said, what I can tell you is that I have a much more present and acute awareness of Jesus' love and grace and mercy and acceptance for me as I am than I ever had before. And knowing his love in the midst of the disastrousness of my life, that fills me with hope and joy and peace and patience and kindness. And you know, that sounds like the fruit of the Spirit. And when you see Missy's love for Chris as he is, even though Chris is still in denial, I'm working to change, I will get better. It's like, really? Seriously? Pretty sure you're not going to. And what does she say? If a wife he loves and two daughters can't change him, nothing will. He needs more help than I can give him. And he needs God's help. Right? Jesus sees the disastrousness of our situation, and he sees that the only possible solution is his death. There can only be a radical solution to the radical brokenness and boundness and recidivistic tendencies of our lives. And so I listen to that, and it just makes me want to weep to think that Jesus loves me in the way that Missy loves Chris. And that fills me with peace, and it also allows me to love the other helpless, hopeless Chris's all around me. That if God can love someone like me, and accept someone like me, then maybe I can accept someone else. You know, hopefully, and most notably, my parents, my children, my wife, the people closest to me. So, don't know if I've convinced you of the bound will or not. You know, whether you still feel free or not. But you know, however you feel, like I said, Jesus is for you as you are. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for these powerful examples of the disastrousness of our lives and help us to admit that we are Tara and we are Chris and we are Kevin Arnold's dad and we are, Mrs. Dunphy, the Dunphy girls. That we are out of control and we're not as free as we wish we were, but thank you for dying for us, for giving us your gift of health and your gift of righteousness, and for never abandoning us, even when we are in denial about who we are and when we are looking for every means of escape from your love. Thank you that you chase after us and you won't let us go. In the name of your son, Jesus. Amen. Thank you, guys. Sorry it was long.
Thank you.